Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to another show here, Beyond the Cover. I am your host, John Robb, along with...
Your co-host, Jeff Ayers. How's it going?
Good, good. And we want to welcome everybody here to the second show, Beyond the Cover. The first one was great. We are going to have a special guest coming on, Tim O'Mara. We're going to be talking about his books, along with another subject that, Jeff, you and I have talked about, which is kind of involving children and reading and why... I think that the Board of Education of the government have literally lost their way, which is not a shocker in the fact that the governments lose their way because kids just aren't reading anymore. And Tim's going to be a great person to be able to talk with that as, you know, this is kind of what he does. So why don't we go ahead and bring him on right now? And we want to welcome Tim to the show. So, Tim, how you doing?
I'm well. Just waiting on the blizzard here in New York City.
Yeah.
It's got to be scary.
That's good.
No, it's not scary. We got a day off tomorrow and plenty of food in the fridge, so we're good.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Well,
go ahead, Jeff.
Go ahead, John. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to go ahead and start off by saying that, first of all, if you want to find Tim, he's the author of a series that's out, and it's timomara.net, O-M-A-R-A.net. A couple books out. Your next one comes out kind of early here called Dead Red. In early 2015, but why don't
Which
you give everybody a little
last
bit of...
week.
Oh, it did just come out.
It came out on Tuesday, yeah.
Oh, okay, I was a little behind the times then. Okay, good.
That's okay.
So Dead Red did just come out, along with you had Sacrifice Fly, you've had Crooked Numbers.
Right.
So can you give everybody a little bit about, you know, the books that you have out there and what kind of author you are?
Well, I'm a wonderful author. My character Raymond Dunn is like I am a New York City school teacher. Unlike me, he also used to be a New York City cop, and I created him a while ago. It took a long time to get Sacrifice Fly done to the point where I wanted it to be looked at by other people. But my brother Michael is a cop in Nassau County. And I just figured it'd be a kind of an interesting thing that no one, I was surprised that no one had done it before, a New York City school teacher who used to be a cop. And I combined myself with my brother and got the attention of Matt Martz over at St. Martin's Minotaur. And it's been a nice ride ever since. Like I said, three books, and I just started a fourth one, also a baseball title, Nasty Cutter. Just don't tell my publisher that because I was told a couple of years ago, no more baseball titles.
So. What was the spark that got you wanting to write in the first place?
Well, I've always been into mysteries. I never really kind of knew it. You probably heard this so many times from so many people. My eyes were opened. I found religion when I picked up the God Wolf manuscript by Robert B. Parker. Many, many years ago. And I just said, this is the stuff I've been looking for my whole life. I mean, I grew up, you know, I wanted to be Encyclopedia Brown. We watched Ellery Queen and Rockford Files and Columbo around the house. But I never, you know, I never said, hey, I want to sit down and write this stuff. I was into theater and stuff like that. And then when I opened up my first Robert B. Parker, I was like, I think I can do this. It just took me many, many years to actually... put it all together. But the actual genesis for Raymond Dunn came when I was making a home visit in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, to the Roberto Clemente Projects, looking for a kid who'd been out for a while. And when I was there, I'm standing outside in these three immense buildings, and it was very hot, and it's me, this slight white boy from Long Island, and it's a bunch of Hispanic kids and black kids and Hasidic Jews. And I was just like, this is too good. I gotta write this. And I myself as a school teacher wasn't as interesting as I would have liked. So I combined me with my brother and came up with Raymond Dunn.
So I guess the question is, when you're talking Raymond Dunn, and for people who might not really understand, you know, like what type of character he is, how would you kind of put him out there? So when you're on a book tour and you're sitting, you're talking to somebody, and somebody kind of walks up and says, "Oh, you know, what do you write?" And you start talking about, you know, who Raymond is. If he was sitting next to you, how would you kind of describe him to somebody?
He's very good looking. Quick-witted, really curious, very curious guy. He left the police force because of an injury, but you know, you can take the boy away from the police force, but you can't take the police force away from the boy. He's nosy. He's curious, as I am. I mean, when I have parents coming to me with issues, when I was back in Williamsburg, there were different issues than now on the Upper West Side, but I've always wanted to know more about what goes on in the kid's house than what goes on just at school. And I think that makes me, it pisses some people off, to be honest with you, but I think it makes me a pretty good teacher, because I don't just look at the kids and label them. I don't see kids as, black or white. There's a big gray area. And that's how Raymond looks at life. But he left the force because of an injury. He didn't want to leave the force. So when he becomes a school teacher, he still has that cop bone in his body. And unfortunately, in Williamsburg, it can be exercised quite a bit. Williamsburg, a lot of people know Williamsburg as this hipster paradise on the other side of the river from Manhattan. But that's not where I worked. My last school was surrounded on three sides by housing projects. So I was dealing with socially and economically and academically disadvantaged kids, and I find them much more interesting than the hipsters of Williamsburg. I don't think they'll be in my next book. Raymond's a curious guy. He wanted to be a cop for all the right reasons, and I think he became a school teacher for all the right reasons, and you know, just never could leave the old job behind. So I would put him, you know, I was very pleased that Otto Penzler's Mysterious Bookshop, managed by Ian, they made me their February hard-boiled pick of the month. And I don't think anybody had ever called me hard-boiled before. So that was quite an honor. You'll actually find my books under the medium-boiled cat. It's almost like we're making eggs over here in the publishing industry. They're either soft-boiled, medium-boiled, or hard-boiled. And I think I've crossed the line now over into hard-boiled. So, you know, Raymond can be tough when he wants to and, caring when he has to be. So I think it's a pretty interesting character.
One of the things that John and I talk about a lot is the line between mystery and thriller. What is how do you see that yourself, and where do your books fall in that?
Yeah, mine are mysteries. Mine, you don't know who done it in my books until late in the book. I think thrillers, you kind of know. It's not a mystery. It's not a puzzle as to who did it. It's how are you going to catch the guy who did it? And there's I think there tends to be more. I guess the word is, you know, more action in a thriller. Mysteries tend to be more, you know, plodding along and uncovering clues as you keep asking questions. My books are very dialogue driven, and a lot of thrillers are not. They're action driven. But it's a conversation we have quite often, us writerly types, about the difference between a thriller and a mystery, and is it really a detective? You know, my guy's an amateur detective. He's not Jim Rockford. He doesn't get paid for doing what he does. Another guy I wanted to be when I was growing up, by the way. I thought Rockford just had the best life ever, except for getting his butt kicked quite often. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different, you know, there's thrillers, there's mysteries, there's straight up crime, but yeah, mine are, there's a crime to be solved. In the first book, the missing boy's father has been murdered, and Raymond finds the body, and then it's all about, you know, who killed him, and, you know, where's the boy? In the second book, a former student of Raymond's has been murdered, and the mother comes up to him and says, you know how this is going to go down. It's another black kid, and the cops will look at it for 2 days, and then they'll move on to something else. And she asks him for his help because he has his uncle, Raymond's uncle, also named Raymond, is chief of detectives in New York City. So it's one of the ways he can get away with sticking his nose where it doesn't quite belong sometimes. And the third book opens up. The first line of the third book is, I never heard the shot that killed Ricky Torres. And it turns out that a friend of his who had just gotten back from the Middle East, who's not ready to join the force again, called Raymond at like 2 o'clock in the morning and said, I need your help. I screwed up. And before he can tell him what happened, he gets shot and killed. And so it's a, you know, it's, there's a whodunit aspect to my books, which I think put them in the hard-boiled mystery genre.
But they're full of action as well.
Yeah, they have action in them. I mean, you don't want to just constantly have, you know, it's not Columbo. You do want that. You do want the occasional chase in there and the threatening bad guys and things like that, without giving too much away, you know, before you find out at the end who did it. In my last book, in Crooked Numbers, and I'm sorry, in Dead Red, I didn't know personally. My books are about 100,000 words, and I didn't know, as the writer of the damn thing, I didn't know who did it until word 80,000. You know, I was just laying these things out, and I was keeping Raymond moving, and yeah, there has to be action in it, but then there has to be, you know, a resolution. And when you do what I do, the most popular phrase now, Jeff, I think you know this from you guys from the conventions. I'm a pantser. I don't outline. So we call ourselves pantsers now, apparently, or some people want to call us that. So when you get to word 80,000 and you go, oh, that's the person who did it, you got to go back to word one and make sure you've set that up. You know, you don't want it to. You don't. You can't just. The worst is when you have somebody. You know, and we've all done this. We've read books. And we've gotten three chapters in. You go, I know who did it. You know, like a bad Quincy M.E. episode. You know, my dad used to do that. My dad was brilliant. He'd sit at the we'd be watching the TV, and just that, you know, that horrible camera angle where they show the killer who's like a bus driver, just does that little Susanna Hoff thing with his eyes. My dad would go, oh, he did it. That was it. You know, nowadays we joke. My wife and I. We watch a lot of these shows, and especially Law and Order. Law and Order is horribly guilty at this. You know, they have it's a four-act show, and by the end of the first act, the major guest star shows up real briefly, and we're not supposed to know he's going to come back later as the killer, you know?
Right.
Well, you know, you've been teaching, and I'm going to kind of switch gears a little because, like I said at the beginning, you've been teaching schools now in the New York public school system for 1987, so you've been doing this for quite some time.
A young Ronald Reagan was leading the country.
He was, and he still knew he was Ronald Reagan, which was good to know.
Yes.
Now, so you've seen a lot of things come and go. You've seen education systems, and how they've kind of, you know, done their, I guess you want to say, their criteria, their curriculum, and they've kind of seen how it's going. But one thing that they've never really caught on to that I think is the reading aspect and the literature. I think that they still make these kids read Shakespeare. Boring. They still make them read these things, and then they go, well, if this is book, I don't want to read anymore.
Right.
Why won't they change?
Well, here's if I could run the system, which I never would, the observation that I make quite often is the farther you get away from an actual classroom with actual kids in it, the less you should have to say about what goes on in that classroom. We just have this, you know, America has this fear that we're falling behind. And we're really not falling behind as much as other countries are starting to catch up. We've never done, as a system, and I've been in the New York City system for 27 years, as a system, we've never done a real great job teaching the kids that you know, books were invented for entertainment. They're supposed to be fun. And then we throw this shit at them. You're right. We throw this stuff and say, you have to read this, you have to read that. I disagree with you about Shakespeare. I had a good teacher in high school who introduced me to Julius Caesar. And we had so much fun with that. I've always enjoyed Shakespeare. But I think the biggest thing that the system does, and this is nationwide, is we send the message to kids that reading is something you are going to be tested on at the end of the year. And if you're not a good reader, you may not move on to the next grade. Or you may have to go to summer school. Or, God forbid, you may need special ed services. You know, they've done tests with kids who don't do well on tests, but they give them a high-interest topic. Like they found years ago, I can't pull this study, right up, but they did this study where they had, they gave a bunch of high-achieving kids, academically achieving kids, a reading test that was real boring, and then they gave a bunch of struggling kids academically, they found 15 or so who really liked baseball. And they gave them something about baseball. And lo and behold, the kids who were lower achieving did better on the test than the other kids did because they were interested in it. So, yeah, that's the biggest fault of the system right now is we don't teach kids that reading is fun. It's something that needs to be
tested
on a yearly basis, and, you know, you better do well on it because in New York City it affects what middle school you go to and what high school you go to. And God knows, you know, New York City private schools can tell you what the kindergarten. Their kids will go to their kindergarten will go to Harvard at this rate. You know, it's amazing. And the parents buy into it. A lot of parents buy into it. My daughter right now actually is reading and enjoying in the seventh grade, and she's reading this with fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade kids. She's reading and enjoying A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which coincidentally takes place in Williamsburg, which is where my novels take place. But she just got very upset yesterday that Johnny died, the alcoholic husband.
That's good.
She's like, I didn't see that. I'm so upset. And, you know, some schools do it well. I think my school still struggles to do it as well as they should. My daughter's school, like I said, last year they read The Book Thief, and she really liked that, you know. But we, as teachers, we have to kind of back off a bit and not just, you know, have the kids diagram sentences from the book and look for theme and symbolism and metaphors. And so it's like, just enjoy the book. You know, that's really what reading's about. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but the powers that be, the politicians, don't get that. They want to see results. They want to see reading scores go up, and they want to see math scores go up. And I'm actually very disappointed with our governor here. He just he's aligning himself with some charter school folks and some good God. You ever put the two words together? School reform. Run from those people.
Really.
But he now wants the teacher evaluation system in New York State to be half observation from their administrator and half the test at the end of the year. And he doesn't seem to get that we have to teach, and we're being told to teach now in a certain way called the Danielson framework, which really gets the kids digging deeper into the problems and working as a team and showing what they call, the Common Core loves to say, the kids are showing grit. And then this stupid-ass test they give at the end of the year for math is at least two-thirds multiple choice. Now, I've just spent the whole year teaching kids to think critically, to delve deeper into a problem, to discuss different solutions or different paths to the solution with their classmates, and then they give a multiple choice test with like six questions on the last day that actually look like some of the stuff I've been teaching. I mean, multiple choice, everybody knows that. Everybody laughs at those. You know, in the teaching field, we say multiple guess. I don't care how bright the kid is. If they
guess
get frustrated
C.
with a problem, they're going to pick B.
Yeah, right.
C.
I always guess C.
Yeah, that's one of those great wives' tales. You know, my mother said, if I don't know the answer, it's C. Really? What if you do know the answer? What is it then, Junior? So.
Well, now I have to. Now you disagree with me about Shakespeare, but I have to disagree with you about something with you. I never had a bad Quincy episode, just to let you know, and I've watched them all. Yeah, without a doubt, I loved it.
I'm sorry.
All the shows that you mentioned, all the shows you. I mean, the parent. And this is the thing. It's like what got me reading was the same thing. You know, the old Columbos, the Perry Masons, the Rockford Files. You know, those mystery shows, the Mike Hammers. I loved watching all that stuff, and then I wanted to read about them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that kids today, and like you're there, do you see what they're interested in is more mainstream fiction, but teachers have to gear them away because they got to make sure. And you know, nothing against The Grapes of Wrath or, you know, of course, Steinbeck and Hemingway and those. I just don't think that in certain ages, that I think you need to ease them into something before you throw them into that, because it's a much different thing.
Right, right. Well, you know, we are, yeah, we're, I hate to say this, we're still a school. You know, we have to balance, you know, we try, like I said, we're not doing a great job of it. But there's the academic side. We are teaching kids how to be better readers. That's what we're trying to do. We don't need a test to verify that. But you're right. There's, you know, and we actually built into our day now. It's not, I don't think it's enough time, but after the kids come back from lunch, they have 10, 15 minutes of reading time. My daughter has a class called Enrichment. And when I first found out about it, I said, "What's Enrichment?" She goes, "We read for 45 minutes and they read whatever they want. And then they see their teacher reading too." And I think that's real good. And we do. We, you know, you have to pick your classics, too. You're right. I mean, you said Grapes of Wrath by Steinbeck. Our eighth graders do Of Mice and Men.
Okay.
You know, of Mice and Men is just a beautiful, beautiful book. I used to read that out loud to 10-year-old emotionally disturbed boys at a sleepaway camp. And they wouldn't let me stop until they fell asleep. The language is so beautiful in that, you know, and just today I sat in on a class. I was covering a class for a teacher, and they were acting out, three different groups were acting out a scene from The Crucible. They all did one scene, but they did one third of the scene. And to see these kids get involved with the language of Arthur Miller, and then later on, you know, later on they'll discuss the communist witch hunt in the late 50s and who Joe McCarthy was, and they'll see the movie. But to just kind of dig on the language that that Miller was putting, you know, the words he was putting into these people's mouths, you know, there's good stuff out there that falls under the classics. But I've never looked down. Man, when I see a kid carrying Harry Potter or Twilight or Divergent, I go, you know what, that kid's reading. You know, and graphic novels are becoming more and more. And you know, I have parents say to me, "Should he be reading graphic novels?" I say, "You know what? It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's got characters who want something."
That's what I say.
Just read. Mm-hmm. I don't care what you're reading, because that graphic novel may turn him on to something else. Yeah. You know, you don't want him reading just that.
Right.
You know. So yeah, we need.
Hey Tim.
Yep.
So I have to ask, because I have a day job, I write, I have a family, you have a family, you have a day job, you write. How do you balance all of that?
I watch a lot less TV than I used to. And I think you'll know this, when you have a deadline, you just have to do it. A good week for me is two nights a week, and a good chunk of one of the weekend days. And thank goodness right now in New York, we don't have any sports teams doing well, so that really cuts down on my TV viewing.
You mean to tell me you're not stopping to watch the Knicks?
I'm not.
That's freaking comedy in motion right there. That's great reality TV.
One of the great things about this blizzard is they canceled the Knicks game tonight.
Yeah,
And they still lost. It's incredible. For me, if you think about it, like I said, my books are 100,000 words. And if I can do 2,000 words a week, in a year I got a book. You know, so my goal is over the school year, I try to get close to half of the book done. And then I've got those two wonderful months of July and August where I can really kind of crank out some stuff if I've set up the first half of the book. So there is time. You know, I work with a woman who's she's got two kids and a husband in law school, and she's like almost an administrator of my school. I mean, that's amazing to me. You know, what I'm doing is writing the books is for fun. That's, you know, I'm glad I get published, and it's wonderful. I'm hoping to hear that the fourth one will be sold. But there are people doing, let's be honest, there are people who have it, they don't care I'm writing a book a year. You know, they've got two kids at home, and they're struggling to feed their families and whatnot. So
the time
is there. You know, it's always been there.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tim, we got about a minute left. I mean, this just kind of flew by.
It did fly by.
We could have kept going on and on and on because this is fascinating to me. But we got about a minute left. So what we like to kind of do is give you like the last minute to be able to let people know where to find you, what you got coming out, whatever social media you got going on, any events, any blogs, anything you got going on. So you take this last minute, just kind of let everybody know what's going on with you.
All right,
how
cool,
to get a hold
cool.
of you.
Well, you know, Dead Red just came out. And it's available at all major bookstores. And I really would like readers and your listeners to just find the local indie in your neighborhood. Go to indiebound.org and find the local indie and support these people because they've been so supportive of us writers. I'm on Facebook, Tim O'Mara on Facebook. My website is www.timomara.net. I was too late to get the .com, but I got the .net. The nice thing is the Sacrifice Fly, the first book, is available as an ebook right now on all the major vendors for $2.99. So if you're looking just to check out the Irish guy from New York for $3, check him out. You know, if you like it, move on to the next ones. You don't have to read them in order. It works nicely if you do, but you know, the third one has nothing to do with the first story. So.
That sounds great.
The first two are terrific, I can tell you that. So.
Well, thank you. I will teach you a little bit. Jack Knight comes back in the third book.
Uh-oh. Oh, okay.
There we go. Here's the teaser, baby.
There's my tease.
Teasing it. Well, I'll say, Tim, hey, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been fabulous talking to you.
Oh, this was fun. It did
awesome
go really
conversation.
Quick.
It did. I mean, it's already 8 o'clock. I mean, you probably, what is it, you got 8 inches now? You started with zero, you probably got 8 inches out five.
Not quite, but you may have just heard the plow go past my house. But
There it is.
No, the street, 9th Avenue is still clean.
I got to tell you, I've been in L.A. for 8 years, and I do not miss the plow at all. I don't miss the plow.
Yeah,
so,
I like the sound because it sometimes means there's no school the next day. So.
Yeah, that's true, too. You get that day off, I get you.
But I love teaching.
Well, hey, again. Well, Tim, we want to thank you again. It's been fascinating. And keep up with, tell us what you got going on any other time in the future. We'd love to have you back on and continue the conversation and see what's going on further.
I'd love to do that. Thank you guys very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Stay safe
bye-bye.
And go Hawks.
Thanks.
So again, everybody, that is author Tim O'Mara. You can go to timomara.net for more information. Jeff and I have to take a drink because we've been talking too much. And we're going to be back here right after the break.
But first, let's talk a little death, murder, and greed. Those are three great subjects here on this show, because author William Nicol has come out with his latest Jack Farrell adventure in Blood Gold. James Rollins, Thomas Perry, and Sandra Brannan all agree that William Nicol knows adventure. So you need to check out williamnicol.com, N-I-K-K-E-L, for more information about Blood Gold and the rest of the series. Well, when you need to get more than even, that's going to be the question and the answer that Miles Knapp says in his debut thriller, Revenge School. Because David Morrell says fans of Robert Parker is going to love this book. Joseph Fender says a fast-moving tale and an original, appealing voice. So go to RevengeSchool.com now, or you could just be on the list. We want your face. Yep, that's what HorrorSelfies.com wants, is your horror face. Stephen King and more have already shown theirs. So if you love horror, you need to go show it off and send in your photo to horrorselfies.com. Brash Books. Well, what do? They just publish the very best crime novels in existence. Because with new books by W.L. Whipley in Storm Warning and Mark Smith with The Death of a Detective, they are probably right. So go ahead and check out all their books right now at brash-books.com. Author Jed Power comes out with his latest book in his Dan Marlowe crime series, and that is called Blood On. His books have gotten wonderful reviews, so go ahead and do yourself a favor and go check him out, because the fourth book in the fourth book called Honeymoon Hotel is coming soon. Go to darkjettypublishing.com for more information.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Rikes, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlaine Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
That's right, everybody. Don't forget to go to thrillerfest.com for that wonderful event. We want to thank you, everybody, after the break here. It's not going to be snowing in July, so that's a good thing. It might be hot as hell, but it will not be snowing in July in New York City. So we're going to come here after to our next segment, what we like to call What's on Our Bookshelf, what we're reading right now. So, Jeff, what are you reading right now?
Well, I want to talk about a review that just got posted today, actually. It is a book that I absolutely loved. It's called The Great Zoo of China, and the author is Matthew Riley.
Who I'll just read the review. The magazine this month.
Yes, and thanks for that opportunity, by the way. It was a pleasure to talk to him. So the review, here it is. Matthew Riley takes elements from Michael Crichton's classic Jurassic Park and gives them a high fantasy spin in his latest action masterpiece, The Great Zoo of China. Reptile expert Dr. Cassandra Jane C.J. Cameron is asked to visit a zoo that is soon to open in the middle of China. Staff members at the site are extremely secretive and provide few answers to her questions until Cameron and the others witness what animals are being kept inside the compound, dragons. The Chinese government has been keeping the discovery of dragon eggs hidden for over 40 years. Now that they've been able to create a place for the dragons to be seen by the general public, they're ready to unveil their existence. Once word spreads, officials believe the zoo will become the number one tourist attraction in the world. Cameron and the other dignitaries in her group explore the various sections of the zoo and learn about the technology used to keep visitors safe from the dragons, as well as the science and biology behind how these creatures can actually exist. They soon realize the dragons are super intelligent and have a plan to escape. Riley has the ability to take objects such as garbage trucks and use them in extreme ways, creating action scenes that read majestically on the page. Most authors throw in guns and lots of shooting to a frantic and thrilling scene, but Riley can amp up the tension with just a glance from one of the creatures. The science and the setting of the Great Zoo of China make this scenario completely believable. The action's overwhelming, making the reader feel giddy as the pages fly by. You will believe that dragons are real.
Okay, so I got the book next to me. I just started picking up and reading it when you started reading your review, because that sounds like a book that we should be getting. And I know that the interview you did with Matthew was fascinating, so hopefully people will enjoy that when they get their copy of the magazine coming out here in about a week to see that.
Excellent. I look forward to seeing what it looks like in the final layout.
Now, are you reading anything right now that you haven't reviewed yet, but you're just kind of flipping through? You got something new maybe that you're going to pick up too?
Yeah, actually, and I'm going to screw up his name, and I apologize, Matt Reichtel, or is Richtel?
I screw up all their names. Yeah, Matt Reichtel, I believe.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, it's called The Doomsday Equation. And when I see it, says it's a mixture of Michael Crichton and an episode of 24. I'm hooked already. I'm going to read it. So
wow.
It talks about one man having 3 days to prevent annihilation from the outbreak of World War III. It's like, okay, I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
So that's what I'm starting to read now. Yeah.
Now, what I got here is I just picked this up. I didn't even know it came. I went into our book room where I think we got about 1,000 books. We just started putting some to the library. I think about 250 we took over to the library. And I noticed that the new Harlan Coben came, The Stranger. And we just kind of talked off the break, and you just got that one too. And mm-hmm. I would say that out of 100 books, let's just say that I read 100 books, maybe 10 intrigue me to keep going. So I'm about a 10%er. If I pick up 100 books, I'll finish 10 because the other 90 either didn't keep my attention, it started getting stupid, there was just some too unbelievable stuff, I just couldn't connect or whatever reason. But right now, The Stranger really has me hooked. I'm a little over halfway through, and Harlan's doing a very good job. I know his last book was a little bit off. I don't think a lot of people really enjoyed it, but I think he came back strong with this one, and I'm not done yet, but it intrigues me. I mean, that's about the praise I can give a book, is if you intrigue me to want me to keep going. And so far, he has. And I think that I'm going to keep, I'm going to finish it now because I got to see how it ends. I got to see the mystery behind this one where a stranger kind of, and here's a scenario for you. A stranger walks up to you, Jeff. This is kind of the scenario in the book. A stranger walks up to you at a bar and says, yeah, you know that pregnancy your wife had a couple years ago? Yeah, she faked it so you would stay with her. And you're like, who the hell are you? And he's like, yeah, why don't you check out your credit card statement for this credit card receipt and go see what that company does, and then you tell me. Now, would you be intrigued to figure out, first of all, who the hell is it, why it's going on with your wife, and everything else, and be like, how the hell does this person know? So.
Coben is a master at the what is going on real quick.
Mm-hmm.
He really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds intriguing.
A couple other things, and I'm not going to read the full reviews because we got 20 pages of them in the new magazine coming up. And I will say that there's a couple books that really got my attention that we rated very, very high. One is Diagon by Tess Gerritsen, who I can say on our next show, she's going to be on. Tess Gerritsen's coming on to talk about Diagon, so that's going to be interesting. That book we rated extremely
high. I talked about
high.
That last ish, or our last show. Yeah,
yep,
I love that book.
You did.
Yeah.
The other one
mm-hmm.
is by Alex Cava, Breaking Creed. That one we have rated extremely high, and that should be on everybody's books, our reading list. Another one by an author, I don't know if you know this author, I've never heard of this one, but Andrew Main, called Angel Killer. It's an FBI agent. It's the first in a series, but it looks like it's going to have some legs. And the reviewer just
said
the end.
I reviewed that book for RT.
Yeah, and now our review said it's created an unbelievably unforgettable book, 5 stars. What did you think?
Mm-hmm. I would agree, actually.
And so those are just a couple that we have that are going to be, like I said, 20 pages. I can't go through all of them. But basically, if anyone knows the magazine, you know that any book that we review, we pretty much have acknowledged that it's good because we never get bad reviews just because it's not our place to rip somebody's work because somebody will like it. I mean, hell, I didn't like Eyes Wide Shut, but I'm sure somebody did. So I'm not going to, you know, talk bad about it. So that's kind of like how we, just for people who might not know the magazine, that's kind of how we do. But there is one subject that I would like to bring up, Jeff. I don't know what you think about this, but I see this happening more and more and more and more. And that's authors, big authors, co-authoring with lesser authors. And sometimes it works, sometimes it falls flat. So how do you feel about like a big author co-writing with a lesser author? And we talked about this a little bit last week with Piranha, because I'm very intrigued about Boyd Morrison and what he's doing with Clive Cussler, because I love Boyd's work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to see what he does, because
right.
we all know Clive really doesn't write anymore. He just does more of the edit and the storylines and the maneuvering. So it's going to be a lot of Boyd's words in there, and that's why I'm really curious to see how it comes out. But how do you feel? What side of the fence are you on? Do you kind of take that, or do you kind of leave it?
As far as I'm concerned, if it's a good book, I don't care who wrote it. That's how I look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if I got asked to do it with another author, I'd say, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have a book that just came out that I wrote with somebody else.
But
so
saying,
I think co-authoring works.
I think co-authoring is a great idea, because I'm writing a co-author book, but it's between two of us that we're not really known. I mean, we haven't had really anything published.
That's true.
More
That's
like,
true.
What about like James Patterson writing with everybody? A lot of people give him a lot of crap because they're like, oh, he puts out a book every week. I mean, he can't be writing them all. Well, I interviewed James on the radio show, and I've talked to people who do write with him, and he literally does do a lot of the writing. He does a lot of the editing. You know, he's very, very hands-on involved, but I think a lot of people, like I said, give him crap because he has a lot of that stuff out there. But is it too much? Is too much, you know what I mean? Is it becoming too much? Are you starting to see it? Because, I mean, it's like everywhere I look, I see somebody's co-authoring with somebody. Now, I don't know if that's the publishers pushing an author to help another author out, but I almost look at it, let's go back into the 80s, where let's say you had a band like Kiss, and they were going on tour, and the record company said, look, you know, here's another band called King Cobra. We want you to go out with them because we need to start selling some album sales. So do you think that it's part of that? I don't know how some of these things work. I don't know how I don't know if the publishers are doing it, if the author looking at it. Do you have any insight behind any of that?
I know that in the case of Patterson and Cutzler, it's them that chooses who gets to work with them, because they've read those authors' works and they liked it and thought they'd be a nice fit. And it seems to be working well for at least the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we're seeing is the more of authors becoming a brand than a writer these days. And I think the co-authoring is part of that.
I was kind of hoping you would say that because we talked about that off the air a little bit, where I just said, I just realized I'm not a series guy. I've come to the realization where I'm not a guy who really likes series long. And I'm talking whether it's TV or I'm talking whether it's books. And like I said before, when we were off the air, I said, Gotham, Sleepy Hollow, Blacklist, some of these shows, I got, when they left for the break and now they've come back, I haven't missed them and I haven't seeked them out because they kind of got boring to me. I was like, oh, you know, here we go again. It's a series thing. And I'll just take Blacklist, for instance. You go 30 hours of your life into it, and who the fuck is Reddington DeKean? Come on. Say it already, okay? I get worried. I'm like, these writers have no idea what they're doing, like Lost, and all of a sudden it's like, if you say what's on the island, everything's going to blow up. Then you don't have a show. I think you just string people along. Now, I know you disagree a little bit with that, right?
Well, having just read the new Lisa Gardner, she does a series, and this book is, the way she does it is she has characters from previous books, so you sort of follow them along, but they're not the main focus of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to you is, do you like that aspect of the series?
I do. I like the aspect of where the back of the cover does not say this is the most diabolical killer they've ever faced. This is their greatest challenge. I'm like, yeah, you said that on the last three books, okay? And I like kind of seeing a little bit how their lives maybe, you know, push themselves forward. But I like to see, I guess what intrigued me a lot about 24 was this. 24 was a series, but it wasn't a series. You only really knew Jack Bauer would not die, but you had no idea if anybody else in there was going to be killed. And that's what held my attention a lot. because everybody was really up for grabs. When they shot David Palmer in the neck on, I think, season 4, and then they started just going to town, it was like, all right, all bets are off. Anybody at any time in this series can die except for Bauer, and that held my attention. Did I lose you?
Just for a sec. I have to say, when I saw that opening, I went, oh, my God, this show is awesome.
Exactly.
To do that,
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Man. Yeah. I was a big fan of that show, and I was thrilled that they brought it back for that limited run last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though I wasn't too thrilled with the storyline, I was a little, I don't know, seeing Chloe and Gothic just didn't do it for me. I mean, yeah, when you saw that opening scene and Palmer gets hit in the neck and then, was it Tony and Michelle's car gets blown up in the driveway, you're like, all bets are off. These guys are going totally off board, and they're breaking all the rules. And I thought that that was amazing to me. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, I agree.
And
they were able
to
still keep it fresh.
Yes, every series, every season was fresh. You didn't really need to see season 1 to understand season 4. You didn't really need
right.
to see it at all. I mean, there was really nothing there because, you know, they would explain a little bit about certain people and certain things that were going on, but you really didn't need to watch it to understand.
That's true. Yeah, and actually, they're starting to do 24 novels now.
Yeah, I
and
saw
I'm
that.
I'm wondering how you can translate the element of time and compression like that in real time into a novel.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be a tough because
you don't read that fast, essentially, or you might. I don't know. You don't read you read in real time, but not their real time.
Right. And everything happened at the top of the hour.
That's true.
That was the funny part. Every freaking thing happened at the top of the hour. I mean, what other show left you cliffhanging so much that you were legitimately pissed when it was over because you had to wait 7 days for the next one to come on? I don't think a show's ever done that to me. Ever done that.
It's the perfect show to binge watch for folks who have it on Netflix and haven't watched it before.
Oh,
it's definitely worth
exactly.
checking out.
Exactly. And that brought us to the question where we talked off there again is, I think, and I'm going to go back to Stephen King and his book Misery, because, and I never asked him this question when I interviewed him, but God, now if I ever got him again, I think I will. Is the title Misery, does it actually mean that the author is miserable having been stuck in a series, just like the character was in Misery, wanting to kill her off to go someplace else, to do something else that he really wanted to write? Was that what he was trying to say?
It's a good question. Let's see if Stephen King will do the show with us.
You know, I'll try to get him. I mean, I'm trying to get some other people, and they haven't said yes yet. But I'll see. But I just, what do you think? You know Lee Child a little bit. I've never really talked to him that much and really asked him, but. And I don't know how honest he could be when you ask him, but is he tired of writing Jack Reacher? I mean, you have to think after this many books, he's probably wanting to do something else.
He's said in the past that he wants to do something else, but then he turns around and the next book's another Jack Reacher, and it's probably because that's what we want from him. And I know a lot of authors that don't necessarily write thrillers, but if they have a particular series that they write in, if they do something separate from that, the sales decrease. And so they got to go back to doing what people supposedly want. And it goes back to what I say. If the book's good, I don't care. But, yeah.
True. I guess if you're reading all the Reacher books, and I think the one thing is You probably know when he puts them into a precarious situation, you know he's going to make it out. And it's like James Bond and several other people. You know he's going to make it out. No matter what situation it's in, he's not going to die. I think,
yeah.
And I think that suspense for me, knowing that he's always going to make it. And I think that that's why I became a standalone guy, because you know what? At the end of it, you might not know if he's going to make it. It might not be happily ever after. I mean, hell, Bambi's mother died. Mufasa died. I mean, Disney's done it. It's like everybody else.
Well, that's a standard Disney thing. You got to be an orphan to succeed.
That's true. You do. You do have to be an orphan. But what would you tell? I mean, and so and I guess the whole question is, what would you tell a young writer? And you're going to Thriller Fest, and you're going to be part of Pitch Fest this year, and you're going to have a bunch of writers sitting in there, or a bunch of wannabe writers, a bunch of guys that are looking to get published, looking for people like myself in suspense publishing, people looking for agents. What's the advice you give to them to let them know, look, you got 2 minutes in front of somebody. What do you tell them they need to make sure they get their point across of?
You should have John Land or Kathy Antrim answer that question, because they take pitches from folks at the conference. But they will say that it's all about the character and the story, and it's the what if and so what. And, you know, so, okay, so a nuclear bomb is about to go off in Manhattan. Well, so what? This character, his family's trapped in the Empire State Building. Okay. There. Quick pitch for you. But it falls under that. You want to create mm-hmm. characters that are interesting in situations that are interesting. And to answer your question about a series, I think the best series are the ones that read completely different from each other, even though they have the same characters. And there are books like that out there. And so you see the characters grow, and they're not doing the same things over and over again. Mm-hmm. There's a lot like that, but there are some that are not. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you do like series, you just don't admit it. You like Quincy, you said that.
Okay, but you know what I like about Quincy and Murder, She Wrote and Law and Order and Columbo? I could sit there and go to season 4, episode 2, about what happened the first 3 seasons, because it doesn't make a difference. Every episode is its own standalone. It's its own standalone. So when they started moving the characters forward in Law and Order, and they had, you know, this had cancer, and then they started getting more into the lives and SVU and all these things, I'm like, I'm out. I just want to know about the case. I want to know how you're going to solve it. I want to know what's going on. I don't care about your kid. I don't care about your wife. I don't care about your boyfriend, unless they're an integral part of solving the case or why they're making you so freaking crazy. That's all I care about. Otherwise, leave the rest at home. It doesn't make a difference to me. And I think that that's when Law and Order went downhill, is when they started focusing a lot more on the personal lives of the cops instead of the cases that they were going into. And they should have never made Jack McCoy district attorney. That was a huge mistake, too. He was better as an assistant DA.
Yeah, it's about how many times did they keep changing the cast, because they had to, I guess. But,
yeah.
I look at
really
CSI. CSI is a show I really like, and I'm worried they're going to cancel it at the end of the year now. But
changes. I hear the first one they could cancel. I hear that one is the one they could cancel.
That's the one I like. The others have been terrible.
Yeah.
I love it for the case.
So here's my thing. I do like series. Well, I'm going to explain how I like series. I'm going to tell you how I like series. And there's one series in particular that I find absolutely fascinating. And you know why? Because I knew there was an ending. And I knew that when the ending came, I didn't know what was going to happen. I'm going to give a shout-out to my good friend, but he's a great author, Stephen James, in the Bauer series. You knew when Checkmate was coming out, and it just came out not too long ago, that this was the end of the series, and there was going to be no more after it. This was it. Checkmate, done, over with, finished. So now, is Bauer going to make it out of this alive? Is the whole world going to change? Is Tesla going to make it? Is something going to happen? That's the series that I like, when I know there's an ending, which is probably 24 so much, because I knew after 24 episodes, it was over. That's what I love. That's what I did love about it.
I was surprised by the ending
of
it?
But I know there's an ending.
Were you pleased with the way it ended? With the... I think I lost you now. So he got cut off. So I guess he was going to give a big spoiler out to the ending of the Bauer series. And I admit I'm a big fan as well. I was curious what John thought about the way it ended. Because I personally liked the character. I liked all the stuff that was going on. I didn't want it to end.
I'm back!
Oh, my goodness! So
I said
a lot of horrible stuff about you. Sorry.
Oh, shit. That's all right. Did you hear my thing, though? Did you hear my which series I do like and why I like them? Did you hear that one?
Yes, and then I mentioned that I liked it as well, and I was curious what you thought of the ending of it all in the minute we have left.
And the ending of what? Steven's book?
Yeah. Did you like the way it ended?
I thought that he ended it in a way... I thought it was decent. I'll put it that way. It wasn't a 10.
Okay.
It wasn't a 5. I think it was more like a 7. I'm not going to give anything away because I want people to read, but... I think it
right.
was more like a 7, but I'll tell you, during the book, who he brings back to have to help and the thing that is a 10. That I did not see.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff, we're coming down to the end here for the last couple minutes. Give everybody your book that you got that just came out.
Book is a middle grade mystery thriller set in Washington, D.C., and it's called The Fourth Lion. And I wrote it with a Star Trek author, and he does podcasts. His name is Kevin Lauderdale. And it was a lot of fun to write, and I would love to see it made into a TV series. But, you know, what author doesn't say that?
Exactly, yeah. But, yeah. Hey, you know what? I think it's fascinating, and I wanted to see a review copy because you didn't send it over to us.
You're getting one in the next couple of days.
Fabulous. Well, hey, we've run out of time here, but don't forget, everybody, in 2 weeks, right here on Beyond the Cover, is New York Times bestselling author Tess Gerritsen talking about her latest Rizzoli and Isles book, Dead Again. You're not going to want to miss that, but you're not going to want to miss any of the shows that we have on the station with Crime and Science Radio, Suspense Radio, Beyond the Cover, and the latest one also, The Story Blender, hosted by Stephen James and Jose Castillo. So don't miss out on anything. Jeff, it's always fascinating, my good man. We are going to talk back in another couple weeks. You good?
Looking forward to it.
All right. See you guys all later. Enjoy.